Chaos yet again on the streets of Hong Kong. Police fired tear gas to disperse protesters late on Sunday, as anger over an extradition bill turned into a fresh front against what many see as a broader erosion of freedoms by Beijing. Thousands descended on China's representative office here, a direct challenge to the authorities and the city's political masters in the Chinese capital.
Some binge watchers didn't want to pay extra to stay on Netflix after the streaming video company jacked up prices in May. As a result, Netflix Wednesday reported that it lost 130,000 customers in the U.S. in the second quarter. Internationally, it added 2.8 million new subscribers, missing Wall Street's target of 4.8 million. That pushed shares down about 13% in after-hours trading.
50 years after the historic Apollo 11 moonwalk, the goal is to return to the moon. Unlike the fleeting lunar visits in the Apollo era, future moon trips will serve as a necessary training ground with the end goal of a mission to Mars. The new space mission is called Artemis by NASA. In Greek mythology, the female twin of Apollo, after the moon, a Mars mission could come as soon as 2033. But this time around, the human moon landing, expected in 2024, will likely occur with the financial help of private companies such as Elon Musk's SpaceX or Jeff Bezos's Blue Origin.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Monday. It's July 22nd. Thank you for tuning in for another edition of The Opening Bell. We've got another business week and another business day getting underway here, and there's lots to cover this morning. We'll get to some of the numbers from the markets momentarily, but today on the program, we're going to continue the anniversary celebration of the Apollo 11 lunar landing, which was over the weekend, the 50th anniversary being celebrated in a number of different ways, lots of retrospectives. One of them, just getting underway, is a podcast at the Washington Post called Moonrise. We're going to have the host of the podcast and the reporter who's been working on that with us this morning at about 5:08 this morning. Lillian Cunningham will be with us. We'll get to Lillian momentarily. A little bit later in the program, are you one of those people that brings your own smartphone device to work use it for work on a regular basis? You might be facing some work-life balance issues. Andy Challenger will be here this morning from Challenger, Gray, and Christmas to talk about how it's impacting, bringing your own device to work is impacting the workplace. That'll be about 5:38 this morning. Of course, we'll also keep you posted on the latest news, weather, sports, and traffic as we move through the 5 o'clock hour. But first, let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. The opening bell rings for the first time this week after Wall Street recorded a weekly loss with stocks slipping on Friday. Investors have been deluged with a mixed bag of corporate earnings. Microsoft shares hit a record Friday after the tech giant reported quarterly earnings revenue that exceeded analyst expectations. By the end of the day, however, it was up less than 1%. More earnings reports are out this week. Just as a reminder, at the closing bell on Friday, the Dow Jones was down 69 points. The S&P slipped 18. The NASDAQ was down about 61 points. This morning, markets are pointing toward opening gains on Wall Street. Dow, NASDAQ, S&P futures each up from 0.25% on the S&P to about 1/3 on the NASDAQ. In Europe, markets are in the green. In London, Germany, and France, the FTSE in London is up nearly 1/3 this morning. In Germany, up nearly 0.25%. And in Asia, markets are in the red. Markets in Hong Kong down nearly 400 points. That's about 1.5%, by the way. In Japan, off nearly 50 points, which is 0.25%. In China, off nearly 1.25%. And oil in the U.S. is trading at $56.62 a barrel, which is up about 99 cents. A couple of stories as we begin this morning. Solid gains for oil prices fueled by rising instability in the Middle East. International benchmark crude up 85 cents. You saw the New York prices there. Traders are worried that all fallout from Iran's seizure of a British tanker last week might disrupt supplies. The Social Security system is on pace to pass an ominous tipping point next year as the program slides into insolvency. Due to the rapid increase of retirees, the program will pay out more in benefits in 2020 than it takes in. More than 54 million people receive benefits today, the largest number in the history of the program. And Pampers is coming out with a technology alternative to pulling back a baby's diaper to see if it's wet. The company is calling it Smart Diaper Lumi by Pampers. The diaper has a sensor that sends information to a mobile app. Pampers says the sensor also will track the baby's sleeping patterns. The new line comes with a baby monitor and a 10-day supply of diapers. There's no word yet on how much those smart diapers will cost. Well, if you want more coverage of the anniversary of Apollo 11, you are in luck. The Washington Post has launched Moonrise. It's the real origin story behind America's decision to go to the moon. And it is reported by Lillian Cunningham, who is a reporter at the Washington Post. You may remember her also from the host of the Presidential and Constitutional podcast at the opening at the Washington Post. And she's with us in studio to talk a little bit about Moonrise.
This became my journey, a reporting trip back in time through the tangled web of Cold War presidents and political rainmakers.
You and Khrushchev might be able to come closer together on this than many other matters. Yeah.
Soviet rocket scientists, German missile engineers.
And Hitler himself felt that this would be impossible.
And also American science fiction writers.
Hello. You've caught me typing, but that's no surprise. I'm typing all the time.
All of these people form the real origin story behind Kennedy's iconic decision to send humans to the moon. A decision, it turns out, that JFK secretly regretted he made.
Lillian, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Thanks. It's so good to be here, Steve.
This past week has been so exciting because anybody who's a child of Apollo or even just a space geek has really had the opportunity to geek out over the last week. And I know you've been doing a lot of that here in Chicago as well. We're going to talk about the podcast and all of that. But, you know, as we sit here on the day after the weekend of this anniversary, what have you learned new? What is going through your mind? What is the significance, do you think, of us marking the 50th anniversary of the moon landing?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, 50 years gives like an incredible reason to look back at the story. And I think the thing I've been thinking about a lot is, you know, we celebrate big anniversaries of milestone moments in this country all the time. And unfortunately, like often, you know, weekends like this past one just kind of come and go and we celebrate something in the moment or look back at the story and then it kind of fades and we move on to what's happening next. But from working on this podcast about the Apollo story and kind of the space race overall, I've just been thinking a lot about how like relevant and important that story is still today and how much, you know, the artifice of an anniversary hopefully won't like take away from the fact that there are like some real reasons we should still be thinking about you know, this chapter of American history as we like think about the context for a lot of what's going on today.
The podcast you're talking about is Moonrise, and it's coming in multiple episodes. So we will, through you, get to relive a lot of this moving forward. It's not just going to be a week. Where did the idea come from to do Moonrise? What kinds of things will you cover?
Sure, yeah. So Moonrise is, it's going to be a 12-episode series. We put the first episode in the series out on Friday, and from here forward, it will come out weekly. And the idea is actually, you know, I'm a journalist at the Washington Post, and I've done these two other American history podcasts before, one about presidential history and one about constitutional history. And I've always tried with those to think about, like, what are topics from the past that people today could really use to brush up on because of what's going on around us? And so I was looking out, you know, thinking about what the third podcast should be. And I was looking out at the headlines of today with U.S.-Russia tensions and, you know, the sort of private industry move into space. And even putting aside the 50th anniversary, all of those sort of seemed like compelling reasons to look back at this first major chapter of America's space story. And so the podcast Moonrise is actually really an exploration of why we went to the moon. I think what we've seen over certainly the past week, but even the past year, as we've celebrated this 50th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing, is like a lot of coverage of how we went to the moon. We get a lot of like astronaut stories, a lot of stories of the engineers who sort of figured out this incredible accomplishment of how to get us there. But the thing that I felt like hasn't been told as much is the story of, you know, why were we going to the moon in the first place? You know, and so that means both like the Cold War backdrop, the U.S.-Soviet sort of nuclear arms race story, but then also, you know, why was that the goalpost? Why was the moon the thing that Kennedy set for us as a goal? So that was sort of where my curiosity emerged. And Moonrise is basically a podcast of like a journey to understand why America went to the moon.
The Cold War is the answer to that question, right? And is there something new about that that you found in listening to all of the archive audio and going back and trying to find trinkets from history?
Yeah, there was a lot that I came across that, honestly, I don't consider myself really a like space history nerd or anything. I approach this really from kind of the average person's understanding of the moon story. And I realized that a lot of what I sort of learned growing up in school was, I don't know if I can say wrong, but it definitely left out a big part of the story. And one of those things was, you know, I think we tend to always think of the space race as starting with Sputnik or starting with John F. Kennedy's speech, the sort of saying, you know, we choose to go to the moon, not because it's easy, but because it's hard. And so a lot of the really interesting things that were revealed to me in the process of doing this were, I would say one of them was just how much Kennedy didn't really care about space, and to understand just how deeply that decision was rooted in wanting to just have a win against the Soviets on the world stage. And, you know, there are a lot of tapes that have been declassified in the past number of years from the Kennedy administration that shed light on the conversations he had in the Oval Office with advisors. And there are actually tapes now that you can listen to where he says, like, I don't care about space. Like, I kind of like I could care less about the moon. I, you know, whatever it is, that'll be a big splashy thing we can do, is what he was interested in. And there's just kind of this myth and narrative that's since grown up around, you know, Kennedy having this like great desire for all of us to go to the moon as like a scientific achievement. But those Cold War roots are really important to understanding the story.
I can't wait to hear more about that specifically, because I think what you found is, and I've kind of sensed this coming, and I'm interested to see more details about it, is that had Kennedy lived and not been assassinated, he may have pulled us out of the whole project altogether.
Yeah, isn't that fascinating?
It is.
That, I mean, that was not something I had heard very much before starting on this podcast project, but a number of the historians I talked to, and that includes like the former chief historian for NASA, Roger Lanius, said, yeah, if Kennedy hadn't been assassinated, there's a really good chance, not necessarily that he would have entirely pulled the plug on the Apollo missions, but a really good chance that the goals would have shifted. That, you know, there was already evidence that's not super public about how Kennedy went to Khrushchev before being assassinated and said, hey, like, do the Soviets want to join us in going to the moon? Because we're starting to think this is going to be really expensive and we might not get there ourselves. And he went to the UN and had sort of similar conversations, spoke with advisors about, like, is there a way we can kind of get ourselves out of this commitment? Because I think once he started realizing the price tag and just how crazy and ambitious that goal really was, he started worrying that he wasn't going to be able to actually fulfill it.
Yeah.
So it took other people after his death kind of committing to that cause to really make it happen.
And some of the astronauts, too, that I've talked to about this, they were fueled to sort of preserve and honor his memory. And that's kind of what fueled people at NASA to keep going. And it's hard to imagine that, you know, being in place if he had not died.
Right. And I mean, not to diminish the fact that, you know, Kennedy's proclamation and commitment to it was certainly important to getting us there. But, you know, there are figures like Lyndon Johnson, his vice president at the time, and Jim Webb, who is leading NASA at the time, who pretty strategically said, you know, after Kennedy's death, like, we kind of need to tell people that this has to be his legacy, because it's the only way. You know, they were both very interested in preserving this moon goal and kind of realized that wrapping it up in this sort of legacy of a fallen president was the best way to make sure, you know, Congress wouldn't pull the funding, that the public wouldn't decide to abandon that goal.
You have also pulled some, you mentioned the secret tapes, the secret conversations, stuff that's not public. There are some actual conversations that you will include in this podcast, aren't there?
There are. So we'll include Kennedy tape from the Oval Office, conversations he had with Lyndon Johnson and Jim Webb. And we also have a lot of other really interesting archival tape, because in the podcast, I think one of the interesting things we do is that we start the moon race story way before Sputnik and JFK's speech. We actually started all the way back in like the late 1800s when some of the first science fiction was coming out about like a desire to go to the moon. And then we trace it up through the world wars and the start of the nuclear arms race. So we have some really interesting audio in there, archival audio in the podcast as well, from early science fiction writers who like sketched out plans for how to get America to go to the moon, President Eisenhower's reaction to Sputnik, Truman's reaction to the atom bomb. All of that kind of forms, I think, like really interesting parts of the story of the space race.
Isn't it cool that you could almost sort of flash back or flash forward to now, the conversations that I'm sure being underway at NASA and other places about how much it's going to cost to get us back to the moon, and these conversations and the planning for that. History repeats itself, doesn't it, to a certain extent?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think even a few years ago, not many people would have thought that America and, you know, the administration right now would be setting a goal of returning American astronauts to the moon in a few years. But that's now a priority for the Trump administration. I think the latest number they've said is that they want American astronauts on the moon by 2024. And for, you know, for a good stretch of the past half century, there's been this feeling like, we went to the moon. It was a great achievement. There wasn't a whole lot that we really needed to do there. We've moved on to some other space goals. But there is suddenly this resurgence, and not just in the U.S., but China, India, Israel, Russia, you know, all have plans or already have projects underway to return to the moon. So it's interesting to see, you know, there was one historian who said to me, things tend to happen in these like 50-year cycles. And so maybe the time is kind of right to start the story over again.
I wonder why we're not working more closely with some of those other countries, including Russia, jointly on going back to the moon.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, part of what's happened over the past couple years is actually a sort of move away from working with Russia. I mean, the SpaceX and the Boeing launches that are coming up, where they're going to be sending American astronauts, like ferrying them to the International Space Station, came in response to the fact that for the past number of years since the space shuttle program ended, the U.S. has been paying Russia millions of dollars every time we take a seat on their flight to the International Space Station, since we didn't have a shuttle there anymore. So there has, in a way, been this move to, you know, sort of put it back on American soil, reclaim some of that space technology and innovation.
And a big part of the stories you've mentioned is the commercialization. We're sitting here in the studios of WGN, just a couple of blocks away from Boeing headquarters. Talk to us a little bit about that commercial aspect of it, how companies like Boeing and SpaceX are working to get us back to the moon.
Yeah. So right now, I mean, the big thing this year is that SpaceX and Boeing are in the process of, becoming basically a ferrier of people and goods up to the International Space Station. And they're preparing for those crewed launches. But a lot of these companies, Boeing, SpaceX, Blue Origin, Virgin Galactic, have, a number of plans beyond that. There's space tourism. Virgin Galactic is kind of leading that charge. But then there are also people like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk who have expressed a lot of interest in the moon as kind of a strategic way station for then exploring other parts of the universe. It's a place to fuel up. There's also a lot of interest from these entrepreneurs in what kind of resources you could mine for the moon. So there's a lot of interest in it now, but I think it's also, you talk about Boeing being here in Chicago. It's important too to remember, it's not like space is suddenly being taken over by private industry. I mean, if you look back at the Apollo program, there were there were a lot of contractors, including Boeing, who worked on all of the early Apollo missions. I mean, from the very beginning, the government turned to a bunch of private companies to sort of help power the computers and the rockets and the technology that would get us to the moon. So there is a history of all of these companies being really deeply involved in space.
So how often will we see a new episode come out? I think that's a lot of people are thinking about as we're talking this morning.
Thanks. Yeah. So they'll come out weekly. So our next episode 2 comes out July 30th. But they'll live online forever and are accessible whenever. So, you can listen to them as they come out weekly, or you can kind of wait and binge them like a Netflix show.
You're mainly a print reporter who's become the podcast correspondent, if you will, at Washington Post. What has that been like, the transition? Did you think you'd be ever be doing podcasts and not print reporting?
No, I didn't. It's been really fun. I started at the Post about 9 years ago as a print reporter, a business reporter. I covered companies and CEOs. And it just kind of was an interesting twist in my career that going into the presidential election of 2016, I had this idea that there should be a podcast on the sort of history of each president. And there were exactly 44 weeks between January 1st of 2016 and Election Day. And so I kept pitching it around the Post to political reporters there, someone should do this, every week, just start with George Washington and tell people the story and the legacy of him and keep going. And no one else in the room wanted to do it. And eventually someone was if you really think it's a great idea, just do it yourself. And at the time the Post didn't even have podcasts, but I kind of treated it as a side work project. Mm-hmm. And then it got a lot of listeners and I really enjoyed doing it. And it kind of just set me on this course to now just do these audio history podcasts for the Post.
The Post, the infrastructure, didn't even exist there to do audio, did it?
No, that was, 2016, not very long ago. There were no other podcasts at the Post. We didn't even have, the sort of online infrastructure to publish audio. So everything kind of started from scratch with this one presidential history podcast. And it's amazing to see that in the past couple of years, I mean, we now have a team of 20 people at the Post who do audio. We have 4 audio studios. It's just really become a big part of how we think about storytelling there.
Congratulations on the success of this. You mentioned the number of listeners. The folks that run the Post must be pretty excited about having clicks and eyes looking at things, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's always the point, right? Like, you want people to hear or to read or to watch what you put a lot of time into making. So, you know, actually the idea, even, you know, you asked about the idea to do the moon story for the podcast. The very seed of the idea actually came from a listener who had listened to the two other podcasts I had done and who said, like, why don't you do something on the space race next and the Apollo story? And I got that along with a number of other suggestions for listeners, but that was the one that kind of sparked me. But so, yeah, I'm always really excited to hear what people who listen to the podcast think of it and then also kind of what they want me to do next.
Well, all the best to you and everybody at the Washington Post. And as a space nerd, I'm looking forward to each and every week coming up of Moonrise.
Well, thanks so much.
Lillian Cunningham, a Washington Post reporter and host of a new podcast called Moonrise at the Washington Post, also presidential and constitutional. You can find more at washingtonpost.com/moonrise.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. We're back on The Opening Bell for this Monday with a technology conversation, a workplace technology conversation. If you're one of the many people who use their personal smartphone for work, are you aware of the potential privacy and work-life balance issues that decision is causing? Andy Challenger is Vice President at Challenger Gray and Christmas in Chicago and is with us this morning for a chat about this. Andy, good morning. Welcome back to WGN.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
We're talking about a policy here, just so people are aware of the lingo, BYOD, bring your own device policies. How common are these policies?
Yeah, these BYOD policies are becoming increasingly more common in American workplaces. Recent survey showed about 59% of companies had already implemented a policy where you could use your own smartphone, your own laptop for your work activities, and about 13% of companies surveyed said they're planning on implementing that within the last year.
So I guess, you know, right off the bat, I'm thinking, well, I guess that means it's going to be easier for me to balance everything with work. If I also get to use my own device, I don't have to worry about two devices. But it's a double-edged sword, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there are some real upsides, right, for companies. They don't have to purchase as much equipment on their own. When they are hiring new employees, they don't have to always worry about training them up on the new devices or technology that the company's using. They might have a Mac at home instead of a PC, and they already know how to use those devices really competently. So there's some real advantages, but of course there's downsides in terms of privacy, work-life balance, and security for the company.
Let's hit a couple of those. Let's start first with the work-life balance question. I know Challenger has done some surveys, and there's some other surveys out there just about how stressed we are in the workplace. Is having to worry about this stuff on our phone and getting emails at all hours of the day and night, is that what's causing some of this stress?
Yeah, it certainly seems to be. We did a recent survey that said about 83% of employers reported they would regularly contact employees outside of work hours, and that 34% expect employees to respond within the next few hours, even if it's, you know, early in the morning or late at night. I think there was a time when work activities stayed at work, and you'd clock out, and you'd come home, and you'd have your home life. Today, those walls are really broken down. When you get an email at 6 a.m., you're expected to look at it, and you know, you're still expected to respond to items coming in well past 9 p.m. in a lot of organizations. And in some ways, that can cause extra stress and anxiety for workers.
I dove into one of the surveys, reports you guys issued, a digital dictator report. Fascinating reading, and I just was taken aback by, just first of all, the number of bosses that try to contact their workers after hours. But some of the reasons, obviously, number one would be like a work-related emergency. But I was surprised that a personal emergency was on there. 29% or other personal issue at 16%. So really just like personal issues that could wait until the next day to discuss at work.
Yeah, right. I mean, we spend more work, more of our waking hours in some ways with our colleagues at work than our own family in a lot of cases. And, you know, those personal issues tend to spill over when devices are at your fingertips at all times. And not everybody has those boundaries really clearly laid out. Companies don't always clearly lay out whether those issues should be sent back and forth via text at 9 p.m. And, you know, individual employees don't really always understand where the boundaries really are.
Let's talk about the privacy part of this, Andy. And this, most people who have a smart device that they use to work may already know this, but others may not, that there could be monitoring software on phones. The company could be watching what you're doing. And there's also a chance that if you leave the job, they could actually wipe your phone remotely as part of the other software that's involved here. Talk to us a little bit about privacy.
Yeah, there's some real privacy risks from the company's perspective. If an employee has sensitive company-related information on their phone and they misplace it or a laptop, companies have to be particularly concerned that those trade secrets could get out. And so a lot of companies have implemented software. We found about 21% of companies had this software where remotely they could wipe out all the information, delete it, that's on those devices. And in a lot of cases, that would include people's personal information, text messages, and photos. So, could certainly be an issue.
Yeah, and I know in this day of downloading malware and all kinds of other things, that's the other part of this. Companies want to be able to protect their network if that's how you're getting in to check email or do whatever. That's a huge issue. That could be very costly for a company.
It really could be. There's increasing prevalence of this malware on devices across the board, and companies are certainly concerned about it. Companies are also really looking at the metadata, not necessarily the individual content of people's calls and conversations, but increasingly we hear about companies tracking teams and departments via the emails that they send, how companies are interconnected. So a company may know from a high level which teams within an organization are not connected to the other teams that are more isolated, where there might be more turnover. You know, they know when you send the first email in the morning. They know when you log out at night. They know where you're logging into a hotspot and where you're going to lunch, which Wi-Fis you log into. There's a lot of information that's now being relayed back to companies that employees might not always realize that they're providing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't even think about that, the tracking part of that. But also the idea that suddenly if you get an email saying, hey, you guys need to communicate more, and you're thinking, well, where did this come from? That's probably the answer.
Yeah, a lot of companies are looking to see, identify individuals that might be really likely to turn over based on the fact they're sending emails externally far more for often than they're corresponding with other individuals in the company internally. And they're also using it to suss out the most connected people, the highest performing employees, the ones that have regular email contacts and text message phone calls with departments across the organization. So there's a lot of interesting ways companies are using that data.
Well, Andy, as somebody who has a lot of experience coaching not only businesses, but seeing a lot of employees as well, what is the solution here? What would your recommendation be to both companies and workers?
Yeah, the real solution is that you have to pick some sort of policy and stick with it. In the rush to roll out these bring your own device policies over the last few years, it's really been missed by most companies that they need to communicate to their employees when when working hours are, when they need to respond to messages after hours, and what type of information the company's collecting through personal devices or work-provided devices. That clarity around the policies is really critical, and I think is really the missing key.
Well, Andy, we, as always, appreciate your expertise and great conversation this morning. Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Andy Challenger, the vice president over at Challenger Gray and Christmas. You can find more online. We'll link out, too, to some of the latest survey information here from Challenger Gray. But their website is challengergray.com.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward opening gains on Wall Street later this morning. Dow, NASDAQ, S&P futures each up about 0.25%. The NASDAQ, though, pushing a little bit higher, up nearly 0.5%. Gold and silver also trading higher today. Gold at 14.2810, up nearly $1.50. Now, agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Well, we're hoping we can pick up today where we left off Friday in the grain and livestock markets. Pretty good day Friday. The Chicago Board of Trade reported December wheat up 8.25 cents a bushel, December corn up 7.25, November soybeans up 20.25, and a green screen on the livestock trade as well. October lean hogs up $2.32 for the day on Friday. The October live cattle contract up 10 cents a hundredweight, and the October feeder cattle contract just up a nickel a hundredweight, but at least they were higher. African swine fever hit a hog farm in northeast Bulgaria yesterday. All pigs on the farm, 17,000, will be culled. And all home-raised pigs in a 3-kilometer quarantine zone established around the farm might also be culled. African swine fever just keeps on keeping on. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Monday, July the 22nd. We will see a lot of housing news dominating this week's economic reports. The May House Price Index and June's existing home sales are both out tomorrow. Wednesday brings new home sales for June. Durable goods orders for June are Thursday. We'll get a look at second quarter GDP on Friday. Today on the calendar, Chicago Fed National Activity Index is out. We have a bunch of earnings, too, including Riverwoods-based Discover Financial Services, Whirlpool, Halliburton, and Hasbro, Inc., all reporting quarterly earnings today. Just some of the things that could move the markets on this Monday, July the 22nd.